The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Andy Milligan, co-author with Simon Bailey of Myths of Branding. Dispel the misconceptions and become a brand expert. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Andy Milligan to talk about the book he has co-authored with Simon Bailey, Myths of Branding, Dispel the Misconceptions and Become a Brand Expert, published by Kogan Page. Andy Milligan is a leading international brand and business consultant and is acknowledged as an expert on all areas of brand development. He advises CEOs and senior management teams on strategies for developing and exploiting brands and growing their business. Andy's experience spans industries as diverse as airlines, financial services, packaged goods, telecommunications, sports and leisure, and pharmaceuticals. He has directed major programs in Japan, South Korea, Singapore, the USA, and throughout Europe. Clients he has worked with include Nissan, World Wildlife Fund, McLaren, Barclays, Unilever, Thai Airways, and FIFA.
In a centro, clara, gol! Gol!
Love that. He's a regular speaker at conferences internationally and has made frequent appearances in media, including on BBC, Sky, and CNN, and now the Marketing Book Podcast.
Idiot!
He has published six other best-selling books: See, Feel, Think, Do, which explores the success of instinct in business; Brand It Like Beckham, which analyzes the success of David Beckham as a celebrity brand; Uncommon Practice, which examines the link between great brands and their corporate cultures; Don't Mess with the Logo, which is a straight-talking guide to brand building; and Bold, voted Management eBook of the Year, which reveals the practices that make great brands stand out and turn customers into fans. Andy's last book, On Purpose, is a practical guide to executing business purpose successfully by delivering a branded customer experience people love. And, interesting fact, after graduating from Oxford, he was trained to be an actor. Andy, congratulations on Myths of Branding, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Oh, Doug, thank you. Everybody loves applause. That's
yes.
The actor in me that's loving that.
Absolutely, yes, yes. So now you worked for McLaren. Did they give you like a McLaren to drive while you were working for them?
No, but I did get to go to the technical center, which is amazing. It's about a half an hour outside of London. And have you ever seen the film Men in Black?
Yeah.
With Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones. Well, if you remember, the headquarters is like deep, deep down this incredibly polished white building with lots of scientists and technicians all running around. And the McLaren Technical Center is like that. It's kind of...
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, yeah. I think that I may have seen parts of it on the Netflix show Formula One, where they've had, I guess there's a McLaren team.
Yes, that's right. That's the technical center where they do all of their, when the teams are performing, that's where the cars are out on the tracks, no matter where they are. All of live feed is being fed back and all the data is being fed back to this kind of incredible center under the ground.
Fascinating. So yeah. FIFA, they did give you World Cup tickets though, right?
They did. It was a long time ago, but that was a fascinating
Which one? Which one did you go to?
2002. And you mentioned that I wrote a book about David Beckham and the brand Beckham. And I don't know how many of your listeners will know, part of the story of the Beckham brand was during the 1998 World Cup, he got sent off. And this was part of his infamy against Argentina in 1998. And in the 2002 World Cup, they played Argentina again and he scored the winning penalty. So it was a great moment. And I was there for that game.
Oh, my goodness.
In Sapporo in Japan.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Mm. Well, so this book is one of the myths books from Kogan Page. And I just love it. This is the third one that's been on. I've had Myths of Marketing by Grant Leboff. And I've had recently Myths of Social Media, the first and second edition. So if you update this with a second edition, please come back. And this book is just another home run, to use a baseball analogy. I must say, though, there were a couple of British terms I had to look up. And, you know, I'm smarter because of it.
We like to educate people, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And that's important for me because, like Forrest Gump,
I'm not a smart man.
But, you know, too many branding books have come across my desk over the years that I think are just a little too much about what the marketing department does, as if the marketing department is still responsible for the brand. And we're going to talk about that. But I was wondering have you sensed that in your career?
Yes. I mean, when I started out in my career in branding, which is 33 years ago now, there was a seminal text, which was called Branding, a Key Marketing Tool. And I think that's the way that most people thought about brands. And actually, most people assumed that brands were products, you know, things you bought off the shelf, can of Coke or a can of Pepsi, washing powder, that sort of stuff. And that was a function of the consumer society that grew up very, very quickly post-war, where there was a really focus on selling products. And so the marketing team had a big role to play in the differentiation of what were often undifferentiated products. You know, what was the difference between one soap powder or another? So branding had a big role to play there. But by the time I had, by the time at the end of that decade, from 1990 to 2000, the core book, one of the core books on branding was Brands, The New Wealth of Nations. And what that was saying was actually these assets, this thing called intellectual property, trademark, they were so valuable that the whole business needed to understand what made them so valuable. And it wasn't just about marketing. It was about all the interacting functions from the people departments. Very important. We'll talk about this, I'm sure, later.
Yeah, but also I can remember this always seemed to come up every time there was yet another enormous acquisition by a company. Or a merger, and the financial press had to talk about why did they seemingly overpay for all that property, plant, and equipment? Well, that seemed to generate a lot of discussion of brand value.
Exactly. And, you know, we talk about that as one of the myths that brands don't have any financial value other than, you know, what a consumer pays for it on the day. That's not true. And the first business that I worked in had pioneered the concept of brand valuation, and precisely for that reason, so that when these big deals that were going on to buy companies, often brand-rich companies, companies who had a big brand portfolio, what were they buying? Well, they weren't really interested in buying the manufacturing plants. Maybe they're a bit interested in buying the distribution, but what they really wanted to get their hands on were the brands. Mm. And so there must be value in them. So how do you value them so that you can reflect the true value of the business that you is being sold? And also, so you've then got an asset base on your books that reflects the value of the business you now have. Mm-hmm. You know, there's this very simple piece of data, you can probably find this anywhere online, that looks at the amount of value on the S&P 500 or the FTSE 100 that is tangible value. That's, you know, literally plants, machinery, all that kind of stuff. And intangible value, that's all the stuff you can't see, touch. That's patents and copyrights and management goodwill and trademarks. And from the 1970s, that proportion of value moved from something like 70% tangible, 20, 30% intangible, to the other way around. And if you think about Apple and you think about Amazon nowadays, a large amount of the value is in the intangible assets those organizations own. And that's one of the big shifts in our economy. And that's why brands are so important to businesses. They are a massive part of the value of those businesses, because they're a massive part of the value of stock markets these days.
Oh, yes. And those are some of the things. One you mentioned earlier, brands are just consumer goods. That was myth 22. Yeah. You've got all these others about the value. It's terrific. I want to read from page 6, an excerpt. You wrote, "We have chosen 25 myths that we feel are commonplace and persistent. Some of these myths have been around for as long as we have been practitioners in this field, which is almost 30 years. Some are more recent and are a result, perhaps, of the growing importance and thus growing academic and quasi-academic scrutiny to which brands are subjected. With each myth, we've attempted to represent why it has come about, as well as, of course, what it is. The myths explain the relevant issues to which the myth relates and, for the most part, offer repudiation or occasionally a sympathetic clarification of them." So my challenge here is, we don't have time to go through all 25. Folks can certainly buy the book, but I picked out 8 that, you know, if we have time, we can get through. And these are the ones that I've encountered over the years that have, you know, I'm like Michael Jackson, Andy. I'm a lover, not a fighter. And I don't want to go around hurting people, but I swear some of these have made me want to, you know, slap people. I mean, when I run into some of these again and again, this is how I feel.
No, God, no, God, please. No, no, no.
So
you're channeling my inner spirit.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, or crazy pills. It's like, it drives me nuts, because one of the things like I said, I'm not a smart man. And actually, the more you learn, the more you learn you don't know. Absolutely. And every single book I read, I learn so much. I head slap and I say, Douglas, how did you not know that? But I think that there's a lot I don't know. What drives me nuts are business people who don't know what they don't know. And this is what kind of set me off. So I've calmed down, Andy, but your book, it was an emotional roller coaster for me. But what I wanted to do was ask you a couple quick questions before we jump into a few of these. One of them is, on page 7, you write, "In the field of marketing," I wanted you to explain this, "in the field of marketing and business generally, and in branding specifically, there is too often a desire to use long, complicated terms and words for what are already abstract concepts."
You know, it's a prevailing problem, as I say, generally in business, which for me is one of the most human activities. You know, we are unique as a species in trading. And so, you know, doing business is very human, but we tend to sometimes make business seem so much like it's some kind of highfalutin science.
And oh, yes.
We like to, you know, create new jargon and new terms and polysyllabic words that nobody understands. But it's that old trick, isn't it? You know, if you make something seem really, really, really clever and long, then it must be clever and long, and therefore it must be worth paying for, or you must be worth paying for. And it's driven me, you know, nuts from the start.
And I think marketers are some of the worst offenders.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of truth in that sometimes. And I don't know what it is. I mean, I don't know if it's sometimes people feel that if they create a pseudo scientific or pseudo intellectual name for something, it'll make the discipline of marketing seem much more important, or, you know, maybe that's it. But I think it gets in the way. And I think and building a business, it's just hard anyway, without trying to make it even more complicated by creating strange terminology. So we tend to, as much as possible, and if there's any time where I lapse into unnecessary jargon, just across the airwaves, Doug, hit me over the head with one of your sound bites.
Right. Yes.
Because, you know, really, vans are a very, very simple thing in one side. It's just a very, very difficult to build and very difficult to manage.
Yes, and that's why on that same page you say branding is not rocket science. It's way more complicated than that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And also there's an author who's been on the show 5 times, I think, Bob Hoffman. He's the ad contrarian. Maybe I know a lot of listeners will remember him, but one of his books he wrote was called Consumers Are From New Jersey, Marketers Are From Mars, or something like that.
Yeah.
And in that, he says there's no bullshit like brand bullshit. And I think it's completely true. And this book falls outside of that. Just So that's why I loved it. And it's core, it's myths of branding. So it's just one balloon after another that you pop here. But let me mention that in the book, you have included Jeff Bezos's description of brands, which is one of my favorites. He's reputed to have said, a brand is what people say about you when you are not in the room. And if the listener doesn't take anything else away from this conversation,
let's talk about something important.
There's a line throughout the book that I just love, and it keeps coming up over and over again. And this is what you should know. A brand is what a brand does.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
I've actually gone ahead and gotten that tattoo. It says a brand is what a brand does. A brand is what a brand does. Let's jump into some of these. And like I said, I don't know if we have time for all of them. And I don't know that, you know, just a word to the listener, I'm not sure how long that Andy's going to want to keep talking to me. So, Andy, if you get a little bit tired of talking to me, here's what I want you to say.
Shut up! Shut up! Will you shut up?
You know, I'm English. I'm British. We are so polite.
I know.
You will have to infer my impatience, which will be even harder over the internet here.
Yes, but, yes.
Okay, I'll try.
All right, let's start with a few of them. So we can't do 25, but I picked out a few. One of them, I'm required by podcast law to cover first, which is branding is just about the logo and advertising. And if I could, years ago, I was giving a talk at the local American Marketing Association luncheon, and there was this fellow in the audience who was asking questions about how to prove ROI. I mean, these were good questions. And then afterwards, I was talking to him, and I said, "Who do you work for?" And he worked for like this fuel company, you know, like a oil company where they provide all kinds of fuels and lubricants, and they had a big East Coast company, lots of trucks, all that sort of thing. And I said, "What do you do there?" He goes, "Oh, I'm the head of brand." And I said, "Oh, really? Okay. Well, what kind of things you doing?" And he goes, "Well, I am responsible for making sure the logo is correct on all the trucks and in everywhere we go, and the website and all the brochures." And I just, I listened to this. I wasn't going to say anything. But then, you know, they later got acquired, and he was the first guy fired. And that was just, I just, when I saw this branding is just about the logo and advertising, I thought, yeah, this probably is still pretty pervasive. And then you write, of all the myths, this is perhaps the most enduring and probably the most injurious to an appreciation of what a brand is and the different disciplines involved in creating it. You started to touch on this. Can you take us back a little bit to how this myth got started? And maybe that'll help us understand why it's still so pervasive.
Well, I think the reason it got started is because most people, you know, who grew up in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, their interaction with brands would have been around products that they bought on the shelves, which had to be differentiated by brand names and logos, and advertising that they saw on TV. So,
to a captive audience.
To a captive audience. Exactly, to a captive audience. And so, inevitably, if that is where the culture references are around brands, and you know that's what you'd hear people talking about and people saying, then you're tend to going to be hardwired to think, well, branding is all about the logo, isn't it? And it's all about advertising, and that's it. And of course, you know, a lot of some of these products that were being sold, you know, they weren't particularly differentiated in the product themselves. I mean, it's very difficult to tell one detergent from another detergent. I know Coke and Pepsi did the, you know, Pepsi challenge, different tastes and stuff. But in the end, you know, it's a sugary soda, brown soda liquid. So those sort of visible signs that you get as a consumer that are, that we grew up and became so important culturally is where you would be your first reference point, what brand is. And, you know, and advertising alone as a discipline was not, was not independent. It would, advertising and PR would work together. Sort of, there's a great campaign going on. Then they'd be covered also in the press. There'd be a lot of coverage in the press about this new brand of whatever it was, dishwasher, battery, soda, car. And again, it would all tend to focus on the name, the look, feel, the advertising. Mm-hmm. So I think that's why it's just in people's heads and it's difficult to dislodge. I think, funnily enough, a younger generation who's grown up with a different cultural appreciation and interaction of brands, i.e. they've grown up in a world where brands are not just products. They've grown up in a world where, hey, TikTok's a brand, Facebook's a brand, Amazon's a brand. You know, they're used to encountering brands in many, many different ways, over many different touch points and through many different channels, as you said, not just one single captive TV channel. I think they have a broader appreciation of the fact there's much more that goes into building a brand than the name and logo. Having said that, Doug, it is true that the name, the brand name and the logo are the fundamental building block without which no brand exists. If you don't have a registered trademark, you don't have a brand worth talking about. And when we were talking earlier about the millions and trillions of dollars that are spent between companies buying and selling brands, at the end of the day, what asset is literally being passed from one company to another is not a product on the shelf, but a piece of paper that has a trademark registration on it. That is the asset that's being basically passed from one company to another. That brand name is gold dust. So the name and logo are a fundamental building block, and advertising is an incredibly important part of communicating and establishing awareness, etc., of a brand. But they are not just what the brand is about. There, of course, is the product. We like to say a brand is created by a chain of experiences that people have from the moment they hear about it on TV to the moment they buy it in a shop or they buy it online, or it's not, of course, something necessarily that's a product. It might be a hotel they stay in, a service they buy, etc., right through to beyond. And I just finished off this. You know, you mentioned Jeff Bezos and that quote. We were very fortunate, Doug. Our first book, Uncommon Practice, 21 years ago, we interviewed Jeff Bezos for that. We featured Amazon. This is 2001. Wow. Amazon had been going for about 5 years. And we...
still had a door as a desk.
Yeah. But here's the thing. If you ever get a chance to read the book, everything he said, everything he spoke about then is exactly what's happened. Exactly the way he's run his company from the start. Extreme customer centricity, clarity about what the Amazon brand stood for and the ambition for the Amazon brand. And he was full of these great quotes. One of them, a brand is what's said about you when you're not in the room. Why? Because word of mouth was more important for him than share of voice. Word of mouth was going to generate interest and trial in Amazon. And he understood that in the digital world, e-word of mouth could have phenomenal impact on your business. Mm-hmm. So creating an impression, letting people know what Amazon was about, not only through what you talked about, because they didn't do any advertising, by the way, of course, but the experience that people had of them was absolutely critical. So, and he had another great quote, one we use all the time on this point about chain of experiences, that customer experience, branded experience, it's not customer service. It's the end-to-end experience. It's that whole chain. And it starts when you hear about Amazon from a friend, and it ends when you get the package delivered to your door and you open it. And in fact, from now, it goes on even further than that.
It has what you ordered.
And it has what you ordered.
It's not broken. And it's not a pain in the butt to open. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The amount of thinking that they would do about the experience. And they're not selling product. It's somebody else's product they're selling, if you know what I mean. But the packaging, the amount of time they thought about, what do we want to do? We've got to make this as easy as possible for people to open this packaging, because that's an important moment. They got it. Great. It's arrived in time. Oh, how can we make it as easy as possible? Because that's another moment of truth to open it and get the wonderful thing. And they'll associate that particular moment of truth, the ease of opening, with the Amazon brand. And that's what people will remember when you're not in the room.
Yes. And they've even influenced the manufacturers of the products to have more customer-friendly packaging. And there was another book on the show by John Picot about customer experience.
Yep.
And I'll include a link to that interview. And he talked about how Amazon doesn't like it when people use a box cutter to have to open the packaging from the manufacturer, and then they end up cutting themselves.
Yeah.
So it was Amazon that took it upon themselves to
to
do what they could.
Exactly.
TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flip the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Yeah, for me, brand and customer centricity completely intertwined. You know, your brand, you want your brand to stand for something in your target customer or consumer's mind. So you've got to deliver something that's going to stick in their mind. And so you've got to find out what they value. And again, one of the things he was talking about then, they still does, is extreme customer centricity. You know, we start with the customer and then we work back from there. So everything inside the business was about what's the customer insight that is going to drive what we need to do. And you're absolutely right. One of those was the package arrives. It's a pain to open, or I cut myself. Well, you're going to blame Amazon for that in some way. So
so they took ownership of it.
So they took ownership of it, exactly. And they controlled what they could control. And that's the other thing about branding is make sure you really control and over-index positively on those things you can control.
So let me just kick this dead horse one more time, because we talked about logo and advertising, and you write, all these elements of the management of a brand's identity are but the tip of an iceberg. Mm. And that's in the section on brands are built through a chain of experiences. And one of the things that's really important, and we're going to talk even more about it, is where you say on page 56, the people in frontline service roles are driving the perceptions of the brand.
Yes.
So let's go to another one, which is number 14. You know, and I think the reasons I picked some of these is because I want the CEOs to understand this. I think the marketing people know a lot of this. But a brand is owned by the marketing department. That's a myth, okay?
Yes.
And it brings to mind the David Packard quote. He was the co-founder of Hewlett-Packard. Marketing is too important to be left to the marketing department. And he didn't mean you don't need a marketing department. Mm. But this sort of goes back to what you were talking about in the Mad Men era of what they were perceived to own the brand because it was more visual. Let me just jump to something you see on page 128, which is really fascinating. The interesting thing about brands is that it is the customer who owns them.
Brands like to control as much as they possibly can the way people think about the brand. And of course they do. They want to make people feel this is a great product, a great company, a great, you know.
And I would think that in the past, they could control a little bit more.
They could. But in the end, the impressions that you leave in the mind of a consumer are driven, that's people like you and me, of course, by the way, are driven by so many multiple different touch points that you've got to really work really hard if you want to own that real estate in their mind and control it in the way. Otherwise, they will get an impression of you. If you don't if you are not really on every single touch point that is going to affect that customer's impression of you, then you are allowing your customer to come up with their own impression of you.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why the people who represent you, the frontline staff or the people working in stores that represent you or the people in the front, they're going to have an impression on you and what people think about you. And that's why we say, ultimately, brand is very much an intellectual concept. The product or the service is a manifestation of it at any one time. I mean, you know, you think about IBM. I mean, IBM has been through so many different manifestations of products all through its life. It sold typewriters and big compute mainframes and then laptops, and now it doesn't sell anything. But we all know, and we have a point of view about the IBM brand. And that's why we say it lives in the mind of the customer. And that is why you have to work really, really hard to make sure that what you're saying in advertising is going to be delivered consistently through all the other touch points, not just the product, but the people who encounter, where it's sold, how it's sold, other services that might be provided by it. Because it's a difficult part of somebody's psyche to completely control the mind. So you've got to really, really work hard at that. Because in the end, somebody's going to take away, it's back to that Jeff Bezos quote, when you're not in the room, what are they thinking about you? Because the brand exists in their mind.
And you talk about how, you know, they're gonna fill that void up with their perceptions of you if you don't do it yourself.
Yeah, and those perceptions may be being created, and this is one of the problems nowadays with social media. Sometimes those perceptions are going to be created by your competitors, or worse still, by people who don't like your brand because of what you did to them when they were trying to buy your brand or when they bought your brand.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we go back to that whole point about why did Jeff Bezos say the brand is what's said about you in your room, it's connected to his complete understanding of the importance of word of mouth and driving his business and continue to drive his business and all great businesses. Advocacy is very important. It's because, you know, the economic impact of a customer not liking you, having a bad impression of you, thinking negatively about you, is not just that they won't buy from you again, it's they'll prevent lots of other people trialing you, because they will tell, in the old days, you know, you say maybe like a dozen, you tell 20
your neighbors.
Yeah. You know, now in the social world, in the social media world, that huge community, they can reach out and they can put a blog, they can do a Facebook post, they can do an Instagram post, they can do a TikTok video nowadays, that can spread quite quickly a story about your brand that is unfavorable.
Yes.
And that's going to infect the impression in customers' mind that you're not controlling. That's why we say the brand is not just the marketing department's responsibility. You know, it starts at the very top of the organization, and you have to think very carefully about that chain of experiences that are going to affect the impression of your brand. How are we making sure it's consistent? And you're never going to get it 100% right. Nobody ever does. But if you get it right enough times, people will forgive you when you get it wrong.
I think the bar is pretty low. If you just make the effort, I'm so delighted. Like if the plane lands in the right city on the right day, I'm thrilled.
Well, here's a great story. I mean, about what I mean, and it relates to a company called Virgin, which you probably know, but many people have heard of Virgin Atlantic.
Oh yeah, you talk about it in the book quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they also had in the UK the franchise to run some of the train services in the UK, Virgin Trains, and there was one moment where a passenger went to the toilet on a Virgin train, and, you know, he was on the toilet. And then he realized there was no toilet paper, and he did not want to leave the toilet because there was no toilet paper. And what was he going to do? Well, it's actually at a critical touch point for a customer on a passenger train. No toilet paper in the toilet is quite significant, you know? Anyway, he tweeted. He said, stuck on a Virgin train with no toilet paper. What do I do? Virgin picked up that tweet, worked out what train it was on, and a few minutes later, there was a knock on the door, and the passenger had handed some toilet paper. And it sounds like a trivial example, but actually you think about what had to happen to enable that customer recovery.
Right. What had to be engineered organizationally beforehand?
Exactly. How vigilant they had to be as a company to look at and follow what people were saying on Twitter to pick up, here's an issue with a customer, you know, which we could do something about. We've got a process to contact the train, to let the train conductor know what's happening. And then, of course, that story went viral. And it was a great positive story. So now people think, well, Virgin look after their customers. And that's a great example of it. And we put it in our book and others. And so these examples may seem a bit trivial, but actually, if you look behind what is required to deliver that at a moment of crisis for a customer, it's not accident. There's an organizational intent. And that's what I mean.
Yeah. And it's not graphic standards.
It's not graphic standards.
Right. Yeah. You know, before we wrap up, I wanted to mention one thing that I don't mean to upset you, but you talked about how if you don't step in and do these things, you're leaving it up to someone else. Now, you went to Oxford. I want to quote from someone who went to Cambridge, and I know that's going to trigger you, but Isaac Newton is believed to have said, nature abhors a vacuum. And the example of that is what Amazon did, where they never said, it's not my problem. In other words, they went to the manufacturers and said, you've got to get these things, you got to make these things easier to open. We don't make your product, but we're not going to deliver it if you don't make it better. Yeah. So it's like Amazon or a great brand owner never says, it's out of my hands, it's not my problem. You can't control everything, but they try to influence it. And let me just quote from one other thing here, because for those CEOs who are listening, we talked about this, an intangible asset that lives in the customer's head. And you write, this distinction is important for several reasons. First, your brand is really just the sum of all the things that you have ever said and done. It is the impression that you leave in the mind of your customer. Second, if you lose sight of what your customer wants, then your brand is likely to quickly lose relevance and appeal. Third, if your customer owns your brand, then the CEO is the one who is now in charge of managing it. And earlier in the book, you write that if the brand is the sum of everything the business does, then doesn't that make the chief executive the ultimate brand guardian? So what I'm trying to help listeners do is to arm them for Management by InFlight magazine, where the boss comes in, throws the magazine down on the marketer's desk and says, you need to improve our brand. Whoa. you've got some work there. You probably should update your resume, but there's a lot of education that you should do. And you know, and related to that, let's jump to number 19. Branding has nothing to do with the customer experience. And under the subhead where it says a brand is what a brand does.
Can you dig it?
So on page 179, you write, while recognition and attribution are fundamental to the process of brand building, what you think and feel about a brand is really the sum of all the individual experiences you have had with that particular brand. In today's world, building successful brands of any shape or size is intimately connected to the orchestration of the customer experience. Yes. So, Andy, in your experience, are companies surprised that customer experience, you know, CX as we call it, is such a dominant factor in building a brand? Are they still hoping that it's just a matter of developing a new logo?
I think your example, the story you tell of Management by InFlight magazine and walking down some brand problem, I'm going to whack it on the marketing director or brand directors, it is absolutely so spot on. And this is the problem with the way organizations organize themselves. Is they have a habit of siloization. They have a habit of, well, this is an important thing, let's create a department. I mean, in fact, there is something called a marketing department when, you know, as we said, actually, as you said, a guy from Hewlett-Packard said, you know, there's a bigger thing. Marketing is too important to be left to a particular department.
Now more than in the past.
Now more than ever. And I think it's partly because of our sort of, and I don't want to get too super philosophical here, but we like hierarchies of our organizational structures are very hierarchical. We like to pin responsibility onto things. And so we like to create a department where we can pin responsibility onto it. And that's their responsibility and off they go. And it's kind of like with things like legal departments or the finance, that kind of works because the legal department, it's a very specific set of skills. You have to be trained for years on to know the law in respect to corporations, the companies, intellectual property, etc. Finance, same thing. There's a huge body of regulations and stuff you need to know. But things like marketing and, to a large extent, people, these are messy things. They're not really a sole department's responsibility anywhere in the real world. You know, you think about the people side of things. Okay, you'll have the chief person, the people officer, but who really has an impact on the development people inside the business? Well, it'll be the manager of those people, or what the CEO says and does, or their colleagues. So I think this is part of the problem, that management of a brand, it leaks across a number of different responsibilities in the organization, because from a customer's point of view, let's take a simple thing like a car. Let's take a BMW car. Sure, the product is important, and there's a whole body of engineers and designers who are creating that product, the look, the feel, the style, BMW. And then, of course, there's the advertising, the marketing people who are creating the image and getting the campaigns going. But then there's the after sales. And there's the people in the dealership who are selling to you. The people in the dealership need to kind of, you know, reflect the brand, and the way the dealership needs to reflect the brand. And that's not going to be done by the marketing department. And then, as I say, the after sales, that's going to be done by the after sales team. And that impacts your impression of the brand. And then there's the financing, because a lot of times you might want to buy a BMW using the BMW's financing. And that's a different department. So all these are multiple impressions that people will have on that brand, and they are run by different departments. And therefore, who ultimately is in charge of all those departments? The CEO. Yeah. The CEO. So the CEO and the board are the ones who have got to say, we take ultimate responsibility for what goes out of this building under our name. And what I love about Jeff Bezos, and I don't know him particularly well, so when I say I love about him, it's, what I really like about Jeff Bezos is the point you were making, Doug. They take responsibility for the customer. They take responsibility for what goes out under the name Amazon, even to the point of seeking to influence the people who are selling things through them, because that's also part of what their customers are going to get out of Amazon. So it is, in my opinion, the most important thing a CEO can do is to be a living day-to-day champion of both the brand and the customer, because for me, they're kind of they are so interrelated. You know, it's like, this is what I'm going to stand for, because this is what our customers value most. And we want to keep finding out more and more what our customers will value most, so that we can keep standing for it. And then I'm going to tell the whole of the business, this is what we focus on. These are things we've got to get right for our customers. So whether you're looking after our people, whether you're looking after our plants, whether you're looking after our products, whether you're looking after our marketing, everybody needs to be focused on these same things and then delivering in different ways. And I think that is something that great CEOs do. And I think that, unfortunately, there are probably still a lot of people who think, yeah, brand, I hand it over to the brand department, or hand it over to the marketing department to deal with issues fundamentally marketing can't deal with sometimes.
Yes. And for those marketers that are facing that, maybe you could just figure out a way for the CEO to listen to this interview. You know, I want to go down this just a little bit further. I want to keep kicking this, because I want to go with myth 23. Brands are just about what happens on the outside. It is a common myth across the business community that brands have a lot to do with what happens on the outside of a business and not very much to do with what goes on inside. This is profoundly wrong. Brands are everything to do with what happens on the inside. And let me just mention here, it has a lot to do with your employees. And earlier in the book, you write, a good brand cannot hide a poor internal culture.
Yes.
And the best way to build a well-loved brand is to win the hearts and minds of your employees. And again, let me just mention two other things. The very best brands don't tend to make a distinction between brand and culture, and brands should apply the same tools and techniques to their internal audiences as they do to their customers. Hearts and minds are rarely won with a 15-minute PowerPoint presentation. If they have problems with the fact that branding has nothing to do with customer experience, I don't think they're going to get to this one. Brands are just about what happens on the outside. Yeah. Have you dealt with companies that have just, I guess maybe they don't hire you, but how would these suddenly these companies start to come to grips with the fact that they can't delegate this to a marketing person? It has to do with how you run the damn company.
Yes. Well, sometimes, you know, there can be a shock to the system that forces them to address that problem.
That's usually the case, yeah.
That's usually the case. Now, I'm not saying that the Dieselgate scandal that rocked VW, the VW group, a few years back, was entirely due to a systemic cultural problem. But the fact is, it was tolerated that and allowed to happen that Volkswagens were effective, that people were allowed to cheat the emission tests, mm-hmm. Volkswagen, and they landed them in an enormous, enormous problem. And I think UBS, the Swiss bank, has estimated that it's going to cost Volkswagen something in the region of, was it $1,600 billion by the time you add everything up in terms of all the legal suits that they face and the bit of lost will. It was just an enormous number. Maybe that's an extreme example of where people don't take enough concern about the culture they're creating that allows certain things to happen. Fundamentally, by the way, are bad for customers because you're selling a product to a customer under a false promise. You know, selling it, they say it's compliant with the emissions. It wasn't. So sometimes people get rocked into it. I do think that what has happened over the last, I'd say, 10 years, I've seen, and maybe it's because of the kind of companies we work with tend to be more enlightened.
Yeah, if they're going to hire somebody like you, they probably...
A new generation of CEO is coming in who actually does think like that, who does want to make sure that they leave a culture, a legacy of culture, which is about doing the right thing and which is about a collaborative culture with a focus on delivering great value for customers and thus building a brand. And I think maybe it's people like Bezos, maybe it's people in other companies, maybe it's people like outliers like Patagonia, the clothes brand, which a lot of young people are very, very, very loyal to, who are so on it in terms of the culture. Tony Hsieh, again, sadly passed away now, who founded Zappos, which Amazon eventually bought, as you know. He was absolutely so focused on building a great culture that would deliver a great experience for customers, which would create a great brand. And it was him who said, brand and culture are two sides of the same coin. And if you want to deliver happiness for your customers, you've got to deliver happiness for your people. And he experimented with different kind of organizational structures to, you know, try to enable that. But fundamentally, what he was getting at, and what a lot of organizations do this right, doing is creating a cross-functional culture that is not siloed, that is not working it to different agendas. It's working to one common agenda of how do we deliver exceptional value for our customer at every touch point. And I think why it goes wrong is a lot of businesses aren't structured like that. They're structured on individual P&Ls. And if you've got an individual P&L, then of course you're going to be rewarded on that individual P&L. You're going to, you know, do what's going to be rewarding you at the end of the month. Yeah.
And they're probably not very well organized around the customer either.
So here's the thing. We talk about the Amazon effect. The Amazon effect is this. No matter what category you are buying something in, I don't care whether it's a car, a hotel, I mean, a finance package, a pension, I mean, whatever it could be, even getting a doctor's appointment. Amazon has so transformed our expectations that we are expecting the levels of responsiveness and personalization and speed and ease that Amazon have set. So if Amazon can deliver me a book that's been out of print for 30 years inside 24 hours, why does it take me 2 days to book an appointment? Or why does it take me, you know, 3 hours to hang on the telephone to get through to my bank? Or why does it 3 weeks to get returns for my from a product I sold back? So they have really raised the expectations among consumers, and consumers are therefore now putting pressure on companies to deliver a higher level of customer experience. That is one thing that is driving change inside businesses, I think. Consumer pressure driven by what they see as the best they get in any category, they expect from anywhere. And that's putting pressure, I think, on businesses to start to reorganize and begin to wake up to the fact that, you know, you've got to deliver a consistent experience if you want to build a consistent brand in the minds of those consumers so that when you're not in the room, they're saying good things about you.
Yes, and that brings to mind the mistake a lot of companies will make where they'll say, yeah, but our competitors aren't doing that. Oh. Well, your competitors might suck. The fact is, they are getting this kind of service from Amazon, and they don't understand why you can't do it. And it brings to mind another story about a MRI machine manufacturer. Mm. They were selling these $1.5 million machines to medical practices or hospitals, and the hospital is saying, why can't you tell us what day it's going to be here? Mm. You can't, you know, I can get that book that's been out of print, and they're going to tell me it's going to be here in a day or two. Why can't you do that?
Yeah.
And there's no good answer.
And you know why? Because the person who's responsible for selling has very little authority or influence on the people who are responsible for manufacturing, ordering, stocking, delivering, and logistics.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably five different departments. But the customer doesn't see that because the customer just sees one brand presented to them through the face of the representative, the salesperson.
Yeah, it's just like they're upset at Amazon because they might cut themselves trying to open that bubble pack, that plastic, what do they call it, clamshell packaging.
Yes.
And it's hard to organize around a customer. And that's why, if we're going to talk about Amazon, I have to tell my favorite story that I've read about quite a bit, is that Bezos was famous for, when he went into a meeting, you know, in whatever the conference room was, he wanted at least one empty chair.
Yes.
And that was to represent the damn customer. And he would invariably point at the chair and say, no, she doesn't want that. Hello? Exactly. Did anybody think about that? Exactly. And then as people were getting ready for meetings with the boss, they'd say, you know what? Oh, he's going to point at that damn chair. We better have an answer.
Exactly.
And so even a company like Amazon was struggling to keep it focused on the customer. And I should add, there have been some authors on the show over the years who say, Amazon is focused on their customers, but trust me, they do not care about the authors. They're like, yeah, we are second-class citizens.
Well, you know, there's a great line by, I think, the Harvard professors, Francis Frey and Anne Morris, and they talk about strategically underperforming in certain areas.
You talk about that in your book.
Yeah, you just can't take care of everything. So I think Amazon would say, well, we're just going to strategically underperform with our authors. We can't take care of everybody.
Yes, but
so that's, you know, that's so then it's up to us to decide, well, I'm going to go and try and get my books sold and our publisher's books sold through bookstore.com or direct or, you know.
But they know what is important to their customers, and most companies don't, think they know, but they are very dialed into what the customers want. And there's just a few things they focus on. So it's okay to be bad at certain things, and you all talk about that. Andy Milligan, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I think it's the thing we were talking about a lot at the beginning, which is no matter where you are in the organization, even if you are not in a marketing role, you have a role you can play in creating a great brand experience for customers. So think about that. And why don't you gently, or sometimes more volubly, you know, promote inside your business with your managers, or if you're a CEO, start thinking about brand is not the responsibility of a marketing department. It's the responsibility of the whole business. That would be one big thing I'd like all people to take out of that. And then they'll realize that marketing, that branding is not just a logo or advertising.
Can you dig it?
That's a great answer, folks. Sorry to break it to you, but it's not about a can of paint that's going to fix your problems here. What is one thing a listener could do today? First thing, just to put in action one of the ideas from your book to get them thinking about this.
I would ask everybody to think about their customers and walk in the shoes of their customer just for one day. You could do that in any way you like. You could go online and try and buy your own product online. You could visit your own dealership. You could find a customer and talk to them and get a sense of what matters most to them. Not what you are trying to sell, but what matters most to them. And, you know, we're great believers in quantitative data. When we approach a piece of work, we do qualitative interviews with customers and with employees. And then we like to quantify that data so we can be really clear that these groups of people are saying these things are most important. We've gone out and did a big study and we've seen actually that's absolutely right. These are quantifiably the most important as a driver as a value for your brand, you know, et cetera. But all that data and stuff, you know, it gets quickly turned into one of those 15 PowerPoint slides and easily forgotten. What people never forget is how they feel when they've talked to a customer or when they've walked through the experience a customer's had. And sharpening your instinct for what a customer wants is something anybody can do in any organization. And they can take that in and they can challenge sometimes then, why are we doing what we're doing? Maybe that customer, what that customer said to me, by the way, was wrong, but it made me challenge, why are we doing, what are we doing? How can we improve what we're doing? And maybe I can also feed up into the mix of the company. You know, I've been going, checking out our own website. It's poor. What are we doing about it? Because that's our front face of the business and it's poor or whatever it might be. So,
yeah, that is such valuable advice. It really is. That's some of the best advice. Just walk in the shoes of your customer for a day. Most companies don't do it. A lot of people don't take ownership of it. And a couple things you don't want to say to folks, what's most important to you? Ask them
just have a conversation
and don't say, what do you want?
Yeah, don't say what do you want. Yeah.
Don't say what do you want. Just say what. Just talk to these folks. Just listen. Some of the best business ideas I've ever had, or particularly for clients, just come from ethnographic research.
Ask absolutely. And you mentioned one of the earlier books, See, Feel, Think, Do. That was what that was about. Seeing what people are doing. What were they feeling? And what did you feel about what you were seeing? Thinking, well, what are we going to do about that? And then doing something about it. And it starts going out. You know, it goes back to that story you were telling. It's actually very true that in every room in which a decision is being made at Amazon, there is a chair kept empty for the customer. And it derives from a psychotherapy process called Gestalt theory. In other words, you know, you put all your issues on that chair. That chair becomes a gestalt, a bigger thing. And in this case, it's the customer.
Yes. You've written so many books. We could have like a Andy Milligan festival.
Let's do that in Virginia.
Yes. Please come visit.
We can have a book. In fact, you should turn this into the marketing book podcast festival.
Yes.
Burgers and beers for
adult beverages. In fact, if there's any listeners in the Norfolk or, you know, Virginia Beach area, please stop by for adult beverages. The only thing I ask is that you bring the adult beverages.
Yes.
That's the only thing I ask. But we should have like a little meetup here. Well, let me ask, looking back on your career, what books have most inspired it?
There are three books, business-related books, because as I said, I'm an English student or English major, I think is the term you use in the States.
Thank you for speaking American, however briefly. Yeah.
What's the phrase that we're two countries separated by a common language?
Yes.
There are three books that kind of like gone woof. One of them is as old as time, and it's Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People.
Yes.
And if I could make it a book on every school curriculum, let alone every business school curriculum, or put it into the hands of every person who comes to the door in any business, it is the lessons in it, the extreme empathy that it talks about are so great. I didn't read it till I was almost 30, and I just thought, oh, I would have saved myself so many problems if I'd read this when I was 25.
And it was written like in 1936.
Yeah, it is. And they've updated it a little bit from time to time, but you know, I think I recommend everybody.
Yeah, that's a great idea. They should put that in the schools.
Yeah, because it teaches you, it's not just about business, it's about life skills. It's about very important skills around, you know, trying to understand others. And therefore, by understanding everything we were talking about brands and customers, trying to understand people who are not you. How do you get to that understanding so that you can help them and they can help you? The second book, it won't be so well known. It's called We, Me, Them, It. And it's by an English business author called John Simmons. And it's a book about tone of voice. It's a book about the importance of writing in business and how much writing in business is terrible.
Oh, yes.
Gobbledygook. Jargonistic, overcomplicated stuff. You can't, you know, you need a special dictionary to kind of, whereas we, me, them, and it is about trying to find ways to understand how you can connect through good human writing. Write human.
Yeah. We, me, them, and it, how to write powerfully.
We, me, them, it. We,
for business.
What are we, the business about? Me, what is my tone of voice with inside this business I work for? Them, our customers. What is it that they want to hear from us? What are they, you know, how do they listen? How do they talk? And it, what is it we're trying to sell to them?
Yeah, and it looks like a pretty new book. It's from Lyd Publishing. He lives there in London, just like you.
He does. It was originally published 20 odd years ago. It was just republished last year.
Oh.
And it's a really good book. So We, Me, Them, In It. And the final book I recommend, which is actually a bit more of a hard slog to read, and I wouldn't have read it if I hadn't been sent on a mini MBA course many years ago by the company I used to work for, and went to Babson College in Massachusetts, just a little bit outside of Harvard. And the faculty at Babson College used many of the faculty from Harvard Business School. And the book that was kind of the sort of core text we're looking at is a book called The Service Profit Chain, by James Heskett, Earl Sasser Jr., and Len Schlesinger. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those moments where I just thought, oh, this is so brilliantly. Of course, it explains everything. If you really want to create a successful, profitable, growing business, find out what your customers want, empower, equip, motivate, and inspire your people to deliver that. That's your role as a leader. And it's everything we talked about beforehand. Be the chief, if you're the CEO, be the chief brand officer and inspire your people to be able to deliver the branded experience that customers really want that keeps them returning again and again and again, which as we all know is the most profitable form of new business, is repeat business, and also makes them advocates for you to go out and recruit new customers on your behalf, which is the most effective form of customer recruitment, customer acquisition. Plus, it gives you a story to tell in your advertising, which is incredibly more powerful than some story about, hey, we support the vets or, you know.
Right. You know? Or the environment or whatever.
Oh, the environment. It's an authentic, powerful story. So it's called The Service Profit Chain. And to be honest, it's one of those books where you do have to think, crikey, these people are really smart and they do use, you know, there's a lot of words here and there's a lot of graphs. But at the core of it all is that simplicity of that theory. And it's one that we live by. Happy employees make happy customers, make happy shareholders.
Yeah, The Service Profit Chain, How Leading Companies Link Profit and Growth to Loyalty, Satisfaction, and Value. That was 1997. That's Sasser, Schlesinger, and Heskett. And then I see, I'm reading from your book, page 134, Heskett had the article in Harvard Business Review, and I'll try and include a link to that article about the same topic. Well, great. Well, are there any new or recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
Yeah, a book I recommend, which is, again, I have to declare an interest here. It's a colleague and friend of mine, Louisa Clark and David Keane, have written a book called Catalyst, which is a great book. It's all about how to rapidly turn contacts into contracts. So how do you go from meeting potential customers, and rapidly identify how you can help them, meaningfully help them, and turn that into business? And it's a really good book. It's very well written. It's very funny in places because we've all been on the receipt of some really bad sales techniques and some really bogus attempts to build rapport with us. It's sort of, you know, there's a few of those. So that is
Catalyst, again, Using Personal Chemistry to Convert Contacts into Contracts, David Keane and Louisa Clark.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yeah. It is. That's a good one. And there's some great stories in there as well. And what I like about all the books I've recommended, maybe with a slight exception of Service Profit Chain, because that, you know, you do have to sort of, that ain't one you're going to take to the Sun Lounger. But Everyone, the other ones you can take on holiday and they're a good read.
Oh, good.
You have to kind of linger a bit more of the service profit chain, but it's really good. And they do some great case studies, particularly Southwest Airlines is a fantastic case study in there that just shows that real link between great culture, great customer loyalty, and in Southwest Airlines, until recently, 45 years worth of nonstop profitability, unheard of in the airline industry.
Yeah, they had some problems during the holidays in 2022, but hopefully they'll pull out of that, to use an airplane term.
Which shows you that it's a never stopping business. You cannot rest on your laurels.
It's a journey, not a destination. Am I right?
Exactly. It's a journey, not a destination. And that is brand. Brand doesn't stop. It's never complete. It always changes. I come back, You look what Apple do today compared to what Apple did in 1984 under, when they first had that big campaign, rather than 1984 under Steve Jobs. Unrecognizable from that one product.
Yes. And they're not going to stop.
And they're not going to stop. And Amazon, unrecognizable from what was the world's biggest bookstore back in 1995, 96 when it landed, when it's up to now sell you anything, anywhere, as quickly as you need it in the most convenient way.
Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that you've mentioned, your caffeine partnership site, your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account. And now a word to you, dear listener. I want to ask you a big favor. Please reach out in some way to Andy and congratulate him on the book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast and putting up with my really stupid jokes. Send him a message on LinkedIn or Twitter or wherever. Guests on the show have told me how much they really enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are so ridiculously good looking. And I mean, he's written so many books, this clearly isn't going to be the last one. So now, once he's been on the show, he's got to decide, is it worth my while to come back? And if you're listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcast, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book is Myths of Branding, Dispel the Misconceptions and Become a Brand Expert. The authors are Andy Milligan and Simon Bailey. Andy, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Doug, it was an absolute pleasure. Thank you for being a great host. And I don't care what your wife says, you've got a great sense of humor.
Sweet.
And thank you to all your listeners for listening in. And I really appreciate that.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you are one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."